Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
As the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan, young Afghans are taking up arms. Some say it's smart to be ready for what might come. Others are concerned.
Definitely, it is not a good thing that people are getting mobilized and arming themselves against the Taliban.
Also today, vaccines are starting to flow to Central America. In Honduras, many worry that government corruption won't change a thing.
In Honduras, there's two situations, you know. You're going to die of hunger or you're going to die of COVID.
I'm Marco Werman. And you think sports are just about winning? At the Euro Soccer Championship this summer, it's more than the score.
So the fact there are fans giddily, delirious in the stadia, there's a sense that we as fans will never take this tournament for granted again.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. We start today with the news from Afghanistan. President Biden set this coming September 11th as the deadline for a complete U.S. withdrawal from the country. But the process has been going faster than expected. The Pentagon says roughly half of American troops have already left. Meantime, the Taliban has gone on the offensive, taking territory. With no political settlement in sight, Afghans are worried about a violent Taliban resurgence and are preparing for a fight. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Over the weekend, a resident of Baghlan province in northern Afghanistan sent me a video over WhatsApp. It shows a dozen men standing in a semicircle. All are wearing traditional Afghan pants and shirts. Most look young, maybe in their 20s, and all are holding AK-47s. Safar Muhammad is one of the men holding a gun. He says in Dari, this is the first time he's held a weapon in his life. He's 20. He says, the terrorists are threatening my hometown and I'm ready to fight them. By terrorists, Muhammad means the Taliban, the group that the U.S. fought for two decades and made a deal with in 2019. Right now, there is no agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government. And with the U.S. withdrawal almost complete, that leaves Afghans like Muhammad fearful of a violent Taliban takeover. He fought Taliban fighters just the other night. Muhammad says a few of them were killed, but everyone on his side survived. About 200 men have picked up arms in this part of the country, he says. God willing, more will join soon.
These people that are picking up arms, they are doing this in line with the mandate issued by the Ministry of Defense, by our Ministry of Defense.
Colonel Naveed Kawusi is with Afghanistan's Ministry of Interior.
They have registered their weapons. They are being armed with the weapons that we provide them. They are being led by professionally trained soldiers.
Last week, in response to Taliban advances in several districts, the Afghan government called on volunteers to join the fight. This is Afghan Vice President Sarwar Danesh urging people to stand shoulder to shoulder with the security forces. The government, he says, is ready to support you in any way we can. Shortly after Danish's call, thousands of volunteers marched in the streets in various parts of the country, holding up their guns and chanting anti-Taliban slogans. But while some in Afghanistan see these popular uprisings as necessary, others are concerned.
Definitely, it is not a good thing that people are getting mobilized and arming themselves against the Taliban.
Ali Yavar Adeli is a researcher with the Afghan Analysts Network in Kabul.
People are trying to defend or fend off the Taliban's attacks. But if there isn't any new progress in the peace talks, this will only prolong the conflict.
Afghanistan's history is full of powerful and corrupt warlords, Adeli says. Men who led militias and later unleashed chaos across the country. The question now is, over time, what will happen to all the weapons that the ANDSF, Afghanistan's National Security Forces, are handing out to people? What if these volunteers don't want to follow orders from the central government? I asked Colonel Navid Kawusi about this.
The reason that the ANDSF is involved is not because we're arming them and we're looking to use them, but rather to guide them, to make sure that they don't cross the line, they don't do anything illegal, and they definitely don't go and do, you know, use this group of armed men and women for nefarious purposes.
And yes, women are picking up arms too. Najibe Noor Delavari is 24 years old and is the first woman police officer in Jalzjan in northern Afghanistan. She tells me people have lined up to show support for the security forces. They want to fight the Taliban. Delavari is no stranger to the insurgents herself. Her father was a member of the group. 6 years ago, she managed to flee Taliban territory and take refuge in a different part of Jalzjan. Then she convinced her father to defect. And now he, too, is ready to fight the Taliban. But she knows Taliban fighters have decades of experience on the battlefield. I ask if she worries about that. I'm not worried about them at all, she says. They should be worried about us. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
1.5 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines arrived in Honduras this week. They were a donation from the United States via COVAX, the Worldwide Vaccine Sharing Initiative. Latin American and Caribbean nations have been hit especially hard by the coronavirus. They account for more than 30% of COVID deaths worldwide. But the region has received only a trickle of vaccines, and Honduras has been near the very end of the line. Also, once vaccines get there, it's not clear they will be fairly distributed. That's according to Lester Ramirez. He's a Honduran anti-corruption activist with the Association for a More Just Society. You're working with a team of Honduran colleagues, Lester, to create an open data portal that's tracking who's receiving COVID-19 vaccines in Honduras. Why is this sort of thing necessary and important?
It is very important indeed because the government has been having serious problems even before the vaccine with corruption, with the hospitals. The procurement of ventilators also was a big case of corruption. Public opinion has less trust in the government. So we decided as a civil society organization in Honduras to create a portal where the general public can have access to this information. And we'll be getting the information through the Ministry of Health, through the Institute of Social Security, and through the international community. So our portal is used even by government officials as a source of information.
Are you publishing information on your portal about vaccine distribution that the Honduran government does not want to be public?
Yes, of course. This is information that we are getting that most of the times the government officials and even the president would not like to be public because it's something that hurts the reputation, hurts the trust. So I think that this portal is creating also the situation when the government is obliged to produce information and to a certain extent be accountable.
Do you have an example of something you've uncovered for which you got heat in Honduras?
Political party officials have cut in the queue They brought buses full of political activists. Our elections are around the corner. And people have seen and have notified us through our complaint system that people who are not elders, who are not even working in the health sector, they get preferential treatments in the line. And this is not only through the public health system also, but also private entities who have connections and influence in the government are also receiving this preferential treatment. So this is a situation where we have done our press conferences. We have mentioned that this is not ethical, that this is a human rights violation. But of course, the government has done very little to change that. And of course, we are going to have elections on November, and this issue is highly politicized. But when you have a government that has lost total trust afterwards, it doesn't care anymore about the reputational risk. And that's what we're seeing right now. You know, a government that has basically said, okay, I know that we have a risk. I know that we're going to be reprimanded by the public. But of course, we can manage that. It's a cost that we have already incurred.
And I gather, Lester, you're hoping your portal could be a model for Guatemala and El Salvador. Do you think the governments there will welcome this kind of transparency?
I don't think the governments will welcome this type of information. And we've had conversations with colleagues in Guatemala and El Salvador, and the situation in transparency, for instance, in El Salvador is even worse with President Bukele and in Guatemala also. So I think these types of portals are good practices. They are much needed and, of course, create a threat to governments who are accustomed to being corrupt and authoritarian.
You live in Honduras, Lester, but we're reaching you in Washington. Like many other Hondurans with means, you've come to the U.S. to get the vaccine. How long might have you waited if you had remained in Honduras?
According to our estimates, and without the donation that the U.S. government gave right now, I would have waited until 2023.
That's stunning.
Yes. Well, today, just to give you an idea, a high school classmate of mine died in Honduras. This is something that we are very affected by, especially people who have to work and have to risk it. Because in Honduras, there's two situations, you know. You're going to die of hunger or you're going to die of COVID. So those are the two options for many people.
Lester Ramirez is a Honduran anti-corruption activist with the Association for a More Just Society. He's working with a team to create an open data portal that's tracking who is receiving COVID-19 vaccines in Honduras, which has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the Western Hemisphere. Thank you for your time, Lester.
Thank you very much.
In vitro fertilization, or IVF, in the U.S., just about anyone can access a procedure if you can pay for it or your insurance covers it. Not so in France until today. The French Parliament passed a law that allows single women and lesbian couples to get IVF and artificial insemination. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has been following this and joins me now in our studio. This has been a long road to get to today, Sarah.
Yeah, I'll say. I covered this initially in October in 2019 when the lower house passed the bill. Activists then thought it would take maybe a couple of months for it to pass. It's been 2 years, Marco.
So what is the controversy about IVF in France all about, and why did it take so long?
Okay, so let's start with the controversy. What you were hearing was we're depriving children of a father. A lot of it was anxiety about the role of men in France. Actually, you heard this trickle down to the language. So in French, this bill is called PMA, which is medically assisted reproduction. The opponents would call it PMA sans père, medically assisted reproduction without a father. So why did this take so long? That is politics. The lower house passed it. Emmanuel Macron, the president, was behind it. And then it got to the Senate, where the conservatives really held it up.
So what does this law actually do?
Up until now, only women who are in long-term heterosexual relationships could freeze their eggs, get artificially inseminated, do IVF. And then what this law would do is it would now let women who are in same-sex couples and single women have access to those treatments. And if you're under 43, the French government will pay for it, which is what they're already doing for straight women.
So what were single women and lesbian couples doing?
A lot of people, if they could afford it, were going to places like Spain and like Belgium to get these procedures done. But of course, A, that's really expensive. And B, it's not a one-off thing. It's hormone shots, ultrasounds, tons of doctor's appointments. So that would be even more expensive. But then also, let's say you wanted some of those appointments happening closer to home, then you'd kind of have to find a doctor who would keep their mouth shut, and you would always feel like you're breaking the law because you were breaking the law.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a really difficult bunch of workarounds if you wanted to have a baby via IVF.
Yeah. And I said in the beginning that it's been 2 years to get this bill passed, but actually it's been much longer than that. It's been 10 years. Former President François Hollande wanted to include this provision in his legalization gay marriage bill, but that didn't happen. And then Emmanuel Macron said that he would do this in 2017. And a lot of women who were waiting for this bill to pass put off having children, and now it's too late. But there is hope. Now this is finally going to happen.
The World's Sarah Birnbaum, thanks for covering this. Thanks for the update.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
Hey there. I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Soccer fans have been loving the past few days, what with the European Championships and the Copa America both happening on two sides of the Atlantic, and there is drama. Typically, we'd bring on our next guest to discuss all things soccer, but today Roger Bennett is here on a different mission, and don't worry, footy fans, we will talk soccer. You may know Roger as one half of the soccer commentating duo Men in Blazers. Roger also has a new book out, a memoir titled Reborn in the USA, an Englishman's love letter to his chosen home. And that's where we're going to start. Roger Bennett, welcome to the show.
Marco, it's great to be back.
There are so many great stories in your book about your lifelong love for the USA, but for those of us who only know you from Men in Blazers, take us back to the young Roger Bennett at the Liverpool College for Gentlemen. What kind of school was it, and how did you start fantasizing in that environment that America was your destiny?
If you have seen Grey Gardens, then you will have been spiritually to Liverpool College in the 1980s. But back then, in the north of England was rotting away as post-industrial change gripped Britain and the city sank, bereft. Life felt like it was lived in black and white. And I survived by inhaling everything American I could, the books, the movies, the music, copies of Rolling Stone, the music of Run DMC, Tracy Chapman, Heart to Heart, The Love Boat, John Hughes, the Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning team.
So it was American culture that kind of drew you in. When you finally got to the U.S. for the first time, it was July 1986. You write to how your friend Jeff picked you up at O'Hare and he took you straight away to an Arby's. You got the French dip, first time for that. And you write, I could have sworn a tasted of beef, democracy, and freedom. How would you update that slogan for the 21st century? Like, what have you learned since that first encounter about America that doesn't square with beef, democracy, and freedom?
That trip to Chicago was life-changing. It affirmed, you've got to remember, I felt I was an American that was trapped in an Englishman's body. And this incredible image of America as a place of courage, of joy, of aspiration was built from afar. I had never set foot in the country, despite the fact that I felt that I was as American as Bruce Springsteen in my true heart. So actually going there was a remarkable feat. And it was then when I was 16 that I decided that place was where I was going to live out my life.
But here's what I want to know. I mean, despite your love for American culture, Roger, you've built a career in this country as this engaging commentator on a sport that is mostly not what Americans want to watch. Does that ever surprise you?
In the demo, below the age of 30, the game of football, particularly the Premier League, the Champions League, the US women, the ratings they pull in, the commercial business, the American eyeballs on all of those things are soaring. And we joke on our show that we cover soccer, the sport of the future, as it has been since 1972. That future is very much now. The reality is football is a joy, as we're seeing now with the Euros, where two teams take the field and their nation's history takes the field alongside of them. Ultimately, football is just a reflection of life. That's how we treat it. All of humanity can be found in a Wu-Tang album. All of humanity can be found within 90 minutes of a game of football. So for us, the difference between the two is utterly seamless.
Abroad, soccer has also gone through a ton of changes. And I got to say, it's chastening to see the Euro Championships right now in the wake of this idea that American owners of European football clubs had come up with, this Super League, which would have seen the top teams in Europe competing in one league and kind of choking out smaller clubs. The league disintegrated before it could come together as fans protested across Europe, like here. It's not football anymore, they're chanting. Roger, what did you make of this recent chapter of European soccer, the Super League? And how did you explain this to an American audience?
Watching this wave of American sports entrepreneurs jump into the Premier League, snapping up prime teams, Liverpool, Arsenal, Manchester United, it was absolutely beautiful to watch. But the way they moved this year with the Super League, in which they really invested heavily in this plan, they thought they could turn European football into the American style, the American system of play. And they invested a fortune into PR, into government lobbyists. They had a massive plan where they thought about every single scenario. The one scenario they didn't think about, Marco, was their own fans turning on them and telling them they didn't understand the game, its history and traditions. And the revolt actually came from Liverpool's fans against Liverpool leaving the Premier League in that way.
Speaking of the dynamic between fans and teams, I'm wondering what you're making of players taking a knee to protest races in the European Championships. Not only that, there's also booing from the crowd.
One of the joys of football is it is just a reflection of the societies, the politics, the culture that surrounds it. Football does not exist in a vacuum. It is a reflection of every nation's truth. And Europe, as the United States, is going through an incredible time of turmoil and tumult. And you see that in the European Championship.
I mean, it is a surreal mix of ugliness and redemption with these European Championships. I get kind of a rush following your tweets. And then yesterday's match between France and Switzerland happened while I was on the air, and I saw these Swiss flags pop up on my Twitter feed, then found out what happened, the Swiss gaining the edge in a penalty shootout, knocking out world champions France. I mean, there have been numerous moments of redemption in epic fashion at this championship.
Look, this championship was postponed last year because the whole European continent was ravaged by the pandemic. So the fact that it's happening at all is a remarkable moment. The fact there are fans giddily, delirious in the stadia, there's a sense that we as fans will never take this tournament for granted again.
Yeah, and it's competing for eyes with the Copa America. It is serious FOMO. What is the headline coming out of that championship in Brazil?
When you talked about how football is just a reflection of the society that surrounds it, it's almost insane that the Copa is taking place at all, as one potential South American host nation after another had to drop out because of just the swamping COVID numbers. And Brazil ended up stepping in and hosting it, even though they themselves are in pandemic chaos. So it's been a muted tournament. It's been a tournament of challenge. It's been a tournament, fanless football, almost a throwback to 2020 itself.
One last thing, Roger. We're recording this interview just as England and Germany are heading out to the pitch for their match in the European Championship. A psychic elephant in a zoo in Hamburg is predicting a Germany win. But win or lose, what are you feeling with this absolutely classic European showdown? I mean, Dunkirk is still in the background, right?
This Euro Championship is a reflection of the histories between the nations. And when Germany play England, let's just say there's always a lot of history. In fact, I can almost map out my own biography as a kid, just through the pain and suffering of one tragic England loss to Germany after another, mostly during penalty shootouts. Our heroes valiantly promising they would deliver, hope turning to shattered hope. And there's an old adage that at the end of the day, football is a simple game. 22 human beings kick a football around the field for 90 minutes. And at the end, the Germans win. We are the English national team, truly, football's version of the New York Knicks.
Roger, the book is Reborn in the USA, an Englishman's love letter to his chosen home. Thanks for being with us.
Marco, thank you for having me on. Courage.
And this update from the Euro, the elephant and Roger were wrong.
Here's Jack Grealish playing it in there, and breaks his European dub, and England are in dreamland.
Yep, dreamland for England after beating Germany today 2-0. You are listening to The World. 14 years after his son's death in Iraq, a former Army colonel considers who's to blame.
We the people, collectively, are responsible. We are responsible for the way that war evolved. And therefore, we are also responsible for my son's death.
Also ahead, a single exam in China that maps out the rest of your life. Coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Some potentially good news in an otherwise brutal conflict in East Africa. The government of Ethiopia announced a unilateral ceasefire in its battle with rebel forces in the northern region of Tigray. The announcement coincided as rebel forces were seizing back control of the regional capital there. Tigray has been torn apart by 8 months of fighting, including evidence of massacres and execution sites. 2 million people have been displaced and hundreds of thousands of people are starving. But yesterday's rapid military offensive and the announcement of a ceasefire could be a possible turning point. The World's Halima Gikandi reports.
Back in November, Ethiopia's federal troops under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed secured Tigray's capital of Mekele in a major offensive. Federal soldiers soon occupied homes, and an interim government was instated. But on Monday, everything changed. Tigrayans danced and cheered in the streets of Mekele, celebrating the reported arrival of the Tigray Defense Forces, which for months has been battling the Ethiopian federal government in the region. Leah Kassa is a spokesperson for the regional Tigray government that was disbanded when the conflict broke out. In local media, she congratulated the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, for retaking the capital Mekele and reinstating the previous local government. Dr. Abraham Bale heads Tigray's interim provisional government. On Monday, he requested a ceasefire for humanitarian reasons. On state media, he said a ceasefire was necessary to allow farmers in Tigray to cultivate the land during the current planting season. For weeks, the United Nations has been warning of famine in areas impacted by the conflict and unreached by aid. Bale says a ceasefire would enable increased humanitarian aid and allow displaced people to rebuild their lives. He also claimed that most of the destructive TPLF leaders had been captured and that the ceasefire could provide an opportunity to resolve the conflict. The situation on the ground, however, remains unclear and communications are down across Tigray. In a recent statement, the TPLF said they would continue fighting their enemies. They didn't say whether or not they would accept the ceasefire announced by the federal government. Support for the TPLF remains high in and out of the country. On Sunday, hundreds of Tigrayans living in neighboring Sudan came together for a TPLF-sponsored fundraising event for refugees. Tigrayans young and old waved their yellow and red flags and wore T-shirts supporting the Tigray Defense Forces. Solomon Gebremetin is a TPLF leader in Khartoum. He said the Tigray forces are making gains and taking back areas in the region. Their resolve has only increased after seeing the atrocities committed by Ethiopian federal troops and Eritrean soldiers. But all parties, including Tigray forces, have been accused of human rights violations. And Ethiopians of all backgrounds have been victims of the conflict. Father Kasai Alam is a leader at the Orthodox Christian Medhani Alem Church in Khartoum. As a religious leader, he says he blames Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for the killings and violence across Tigray. He said religious buildings in his hometown of Aksum have also been destroyed by troops. Father Alam says he hasn't heard from his wife and children since the conflict began 6 months ago. He doesn't know if they're dead or alive. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke with Ethiopia's prime minister. Guterres said he hoped that hostilities would end in Tigray so that humanitarian aid could reach those in need and a political solution could be found. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi, Kenya.
14 years ago, First Lieutenant Andrew Basevich died after an IED detonated during a combat patrol in Iraq. The soldier's father, a former U.S. Army officer with the same first name, had been a vocal critic of the Iraq War, but stood by his son's decision to serve. Since that fateful day, the elder Andrew Basevich has been asking who's to blame for his son's death. Last month, Basevich and his wife received a notice from the post office with one answer.
Well, the letter came out of the blue. We both found it deeply offensive.
The letter was from a Washington, D.C.-based law firm, Sparacino. It invited Basevich to join a lawsuit charging the Islamic Republic of Iran for his son's death in Iraq. Basevich was having none of it.
We know how our son was killed. We've read the autopsy, and there is nothing to indicate Iranian involvement. I'm not saying there is no Iranian involvement, but there's simply no concrete evidence to say that Iran provided the weapons, provided the technology that were involved in my son's death.
Obviously, the death of a child is a heavy burden to bear for any parent. How and why did this law firm, Sparacino, want to hold Iran responsible?
In the aftermath of 9/11, the George W. Bush administration embarked upon a global war on terrorism that specifically targeted what President Bush referred to as an axis of evil. The axis of evil consisted of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Soon thereafter, U.S. forces invaded Iraq, embarked it upon what would become a very long and bitter war. And quite frankly, I think it would be reasonable for the government of Iran to assume that if the United States succeeded in achieving its objectives in Iraq, that Iran would be next on the hit list. Therefore, it is not surprising that Iran undertook a covert effort to support the Iraqi resistance, which was opposing the U.S. occupation. That much we know for sure. Whether or not any of that contributed to the death of my son is completely unknown. And again, the law firm provided no additional evidence that would enlighten us on that question.
And this letter went to other Gold Star families. Did you, when you got it, did you and your wife view it as legitimate or maybe an organization trying to cash in on the death of American service members?
Yes. To put it bluntly, it did seem like an effort to cash in, you know, kind of a sophisticated form of ambulance chasing.
The letter and the offer from this law firm, as crass as it appears, it did resurface a question that has been on your mind since your son was killed. Who is to blame for his death? Where are you at with that question?
I think the conclusion that I've reached is that it's too easy to blame Iran. It's also too easy to blame George W. Bush. We elected George W. Bush. We re-elected George W. Bush. And so to some degree, I concluded that there is a collective responsibility for my son's death, and the collective responsibility belongs to us, you know, to the American people.
Don't you think, though, that a lot of American people, even those who voted for George W. Bush, did not vote for a manufactured casus belli of weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist, which were never found?
That is absolutely correct. It's not as if we put the Iraq War up to a vote. But under the terms of our Constitution, the commander-in-chief under our system is empowered to do these sorts of things. So, you know, when I say we the people have a responsibility for my son's death, I don't mean that in terms of an indictment. What I mean is that in a democracy, it's important that we don't pass off our collective responsibility. We shouldn't pass it off on the Islamic Republic of Iran. We shouldn't pass it off on Bush, Vice President Cheney, you know, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and so on. These individuals are acting in our names, and they're acting on our behalf. And therefore, when we think about the Iraq War, which now, for all practical purposes, is in the past, and we try to come to an understanding of its historical significance, I think we have to factor into our thinking an appreciation that there is an element of collective responsibility. We are responsible for the consequences stemming from that war. And therefore, we are also responsible for my son's death.
What did you do with that letter from this Washington law firm?
Threw it away. We have no interest in participating in this scheme.
As you said, Andrew Bacevich, the Iraq war feels in the past. President Biden seems intent on shutting down the forever wars. And yet, we had the news over the weekend of U.S. airstrikes targeting Iranian-backed militia sites in Iraq and Syria. What do these airstrikes tell us about the Biden administration's approach, not just to the region, but military conflict generally, do you think?
First of all, let us take with a grain of salt the Biden administration's claims that it's trying to end the forever wars. That may be the case in Afghanistan. It is patently not the case in Iraq. I think the question here is, what was the purpose of the airstrikes which only recently occurred? My guess is that even though the nominal claim was that they were being conducted to eliminate drone sites used by Iranian militias, my guess is it's really part of a larger negotiation that relates to whether or not the United States is going to re-enter the Iranian nuclear deal. I suspect that some amount of violence is being used to send signals.
I mean, it does raise the question, can the U.S. ever really extract itself from these conflicts? What do you think?
I think it can, and I think that it absolutely should. The global war on terrorism was a misguided enterprise from the outset. If the object of the exercise was to eliminate terrorism, it has failed. If the object of the exercise was to promote democracies, it has failed. If the object of the exercise was to bring stability to the Persian Gulf in that region, it has obviously failed. And therefore, it's time for us to consider an alternative approach to securing U.S. interests, which, by the way, tend to be rather limited in that part of the world, even though we've become used to thinking that our interests there are vital.
Andrew Bacevich is the president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a former U.S. Army colonel and the author of After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Australia has returned to lockdowns in major cities as officials there try to curb an outbreak of the COVID-19 Delta variant. Those new restrictions could impact more than 20 million Australians. Read more about the story in today's edition of our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Lebanon is suffering one of the toughest financial crises in modern history. The World Bank is describing the situation as one of the 10 worst since the mid-1800s. Half of the Lebanese population is now believed to be below the poverty line. The situation is so bad that even usually well-resourced soldiers can't feed their families. As Rebecca Collard reports from Beirut, that's putting Lebanon's security at risk.
In the video, the soldier is driving past a mile-long line of cars that are waiting for gas. He's careful to hide his identity. The camera is pointed straight forward at the road. His military fatigues are just visible on his legs. The soldier is complaining that he can't even get fuel to drive to his military base. He calls it a humiliation. He says he begged the gas station owner to just fill up 20,000 Lebanese pounds. That's a little more than a dollar. The soldier says the owner refused. The Lebanese pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and it's becoming difficult to import anything, including medicine, food, and fuel. These gas lines are an almost constant sight. I just hope that this message reaches the commander of the army, says the soldier. Earlier this month, that commander, General Joseph Aoun, issued a dire warning about the impact of Lebanon's crisis on the army, also called the LAF.
The situation is critical. If unmitigated, the economic and financial crisis will inevitably lead to the collapse of all state institutions, including the LAF. The backbone of the country and the soldiers.
The army has asked the international community for everything from food and medical supplies to fuel and spare parts for military equipment. General Aoun says that if the army doesn't get help soon, it could collapse.
If, God forbid, the LAF collapses, the state entity will collapse and the country will be in total turmoil.
The army has been trying to cut costs. As the crisis worsened and meat prices skyrocketed, on-duty soldiers were put on a vegetarian diet. and soldiers themselves are descending into poverty as their salaries lose their value against hyperinflation.
How can a soldier support a family with a salary that does not exceed $90?
It's difficult to know how many soldiers have left their posts because they're unable to survive on that salary. All the soldiers asked to speak for this story said they weren't allowed. Army's orders. Even soldiers standing on the street corners in Beirut said they couldn't talk.
And I'm wondering if you have a minute to talk about how the situation is for you now in Lebanon as soldiers.
Not talk about this.
You're not allowed to talk about it?
No.
No? Are you allowed to talk about it?
No talk.
The soldier beside him doesn't even say no. He just rolls his eyes back gently and lifts his eyebrows. Lebanese for nope, not a chance. Bilal Sab of the Middle East Institute says he doesn't think the army is at imminent risk of collapse.
But the risk of more desertions or more soldiers trying to get multiple jobs to make ends meet and therefore affecting their performance, affecting their competence, that is a real risk.
The Lebanese army has collapsed before. During the country's civil war, the force splintered along sectarian lines. Since the end of the war in 1990, there has been an international effort to rebuild it. Now, it's an 80,000-strong force with American weapons and foreign training. This promotional army video shows soldiers jumping through hoops of fire and scaling down two-story high walls. But the truth is, Lebanon's army participates in very little actual combat. It's not even the best armed force in the country. That is Hezbollah, a political and military group allied with Iran, whose influence the U.S. is looking to counter. Beyond security, Bilal Sab says the army also plays a role in bridging Lebanon's sectarian divides.
It is the only national institution beyond the parliament, which is not meeting anyway right now, that is truly representative of all Lebanese religious communities.
Western states have pledged to step up, but so far there have been very few concrete commitments. And it's not just Lebanon's army and soldiers that are suffering. It's all of Lebanon's security forces, which have been pitted against protesters in the past year and a half of anti-government demonstrations here. Last year, as security forces clashed with demonstrators on a highway outside Beirut, one of the protesters shouted at an officer, "We are going hungry." The officer shouted back, "I am hungrier than you are." For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
It's exam season in China. The Gaokao College admissions test, as well as high school entrance exams, will soon determine the trajectory of millions of young lives. Each year, the competition gets tougher and starts at younger ages. So along comes a popular new TV show spotlighting what the stress does to families. From Shanghai, here's the world's Rebecca Kanther.
A Little Dilemma follows two families who have very different ideas about their children's education. One mom is obsessed with grades, pushing her fifth-grade son to study at every opportunity. In China, they call this chicken parenting. In one scene, after being pushed to the limit, her son stands up in front of his classmates and their parents and calls out his mom for the mental stress she's causing him. My mom doesn't love me. She loves the me that scores 100%, he says, tears welling up in his eyes. She answers, "How can you say that? How else could I express my love?" The other mother in the TV series is more relaxed and encourages her daughter's interests. In China, they call her a kuaile jiaoyu jiajiang, a happy education parent. They try to remove all the pressure on students to compete. In this scene, even the more relaxed mother starts getting anxious when her daughter's grades start to suffer. She cuts a birthday celebration short when she finds out her daughter hasn't done well on a test. The girl's grandfather says it's just one test. She's only in fifth grade. If she doesn't improve, it will be too late for her, the mom replies. The high school and college entrance exams are approaching. Jiao Hui has two daughters in a primary school in Shanghai. Parents are talking about it, she says, because we spend so much time thinking about the education system. It was very realistic. Sebastian Cheng is a professor at NYU who studies China's education system. He says the show perfectly captures what families and students are going through.
They are extra stressed out under kind of this current competition, and so I think the show kind of really picks up on this ethos.
But for some parents, the show hits a bit too close to home. Some of my mom friends here in Shanghai say they don't dare watch it. Zhang Xiao's son is in my daughter's third grade class at a public school. We sit down for tea in a coffee shop nearby. I saw some clips where parents don't want to give their kids pressure, she says, but end up forcing their kids to do more work in the end. It makes me feel awful. Test anxiety is starting earlier and earlier. Parents are worried about high school, which has a quota. Only half of students will test into high school. The government wants more students to go to vocational schools to ensure there's a steady blue-collar workforce. But many parents see a college degree as a path to a better life. I heard the kids in vocational school don't learn anything, Zhang Xiao says. She's worried her son won't get into high school. He struggles in school. So after class and on the weekends, she takes him to a tutoring center to help him finish up his homework and review. He's there till 9 or 10 at night, sometimes even later. I hate seeing him struggle, but there's nothing I can do, she says. If you can't keep up, the teacher will call the parents and give them a talking to. Zhang Xiao is holding back tears as she talks. It's hopeless, she says. It feels like my kid's whole future is decided by the time he is 10. Even though her son is spending hours in a tutoring center, Zhang Xiao calls herself a happy education parent. I try to take him out to play when we have time, to help him relax, she says. Another parent, Liang Qinghong, is sitting at a nearby table at the same cafe. Her son is at the same school, but in the fourth grade. He's doing well academically. After school, he's taking math and English classes, she says. I'll start him on German soon. She says she has no time to watch the show, but her son has watched a few episodes. He says I'm like the more relaxed mom, she says. I joked with him that even the relaxed mom turns into a chicken parent. In the past few months, the government has been trying to address the problem of pressure on students. In April, the Ministry of Education put out new guidelines. Primary students should only do an hour of homework at most a night and get 10 hours of sleep. New regulations restricting tutoring centers will come out soon. Those guidelines are no use, says Zhang Xiao. The schools haven't let up on the amount of homework, and the parents keep adding to their kids' workload outside of class. Some parents suspect the guidelines are part of the government's efforts to encourage people to have more kids. But Zhang Xiao says she doesn't plan on it. There's just no time to rest, she says. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
Half a day. That's hello in Chamorro. It's how you'd greet someone on the island of Guam, the American territory in the far western Pacific. Since the pandemic, half a day has not been heard by many tourists. But thanks to a highly successful vaccine rollout and now an aggressive campaign to attract travelers, that may soon change.
Half a day from the island of Guam. We have been hard at work in creating a safer travel experience for you and are proud to introduce the Guam Electronic Declaration Form.
The island of Guam, pristine beaches, iconic palm trees, and perfect weather. If that isn't enough to lure back tourists who used to visit from the U.S., the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan, Guam has another proposition.
When you arrive, they'll take you to your hotel. They can test you there and immediately give you your first dose.
Yep, first dose of a COVID vaccine. They have Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J. You get to choose. The vaccination program is sponsored by the Guam Visitors Bureau. Former Guam Governor Carl Gutierrez heads it up.
And there's no more quarantine for you. You can move around, and if you want to stay longer, you can stay longer to get your second shot.
The program is called Air VNV for vacation and vaccination. The first tour group is scheduled to arrive next week from Taiwan.
The first flight will come July 6th. They'll come for 4 nights, 5 days.
Hotel operators are keeping their fingers crossed. The island currently has a surplus of empty rooms, plus a surplus of vaccines. Guam's government says it will free up 30,000 vaccine doses for the program, and the Visitors Bureau is sending out positive vibes to get things rolling.
It's time to re-energize our community, our tourism industry, and ourselves. Are you ready? Let's go, Guam!
Let's go, Guam. Well, it's already Wednesday there. For this Tuesday, that's where we leave things. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston at GBH. Glad you could make it today. We'll see you tomorrow. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.